Welcome. We begin a new chapter this evening. The Ladder of Self-Transcendence. This is chapter 21 in the series titled The Yoga of Integral Knowledge. It appeared at the beginning of the fourth volume of the Arya on Sri Aurobindo's birthday, 15 August 1917, behind the leading article for the Life Divine called Man and the Evolutionary Movement. So this idea of an upward development is present indeed in this chapter of synthesis. We should note that this chapter and the next several chapters were recast, revised by Sri Aurobindo. This chapter most probably in the year 1932. Interesting because his correspondence, as you know, was picking up at this time. His letters were limited to a couple of dozen back in the late 20s per year. He was not engaged in correspondence at that time, but in 1932, he began to answer questions, obviously about the practice of yoga, from those disciples who were living around him there in Pondicherry in the ashram, but also from those who were a bit afar. So in 1932, he wrote about 400 significant letters. That's about a letter a day. In this year, perhaps he begins to think that the synthesis of yoga needs to be updated so that they can read this. And he substantially revises a number of chapters, but he doesn't publish any of it. It's not really published until after he leaves his body, because the only one that is published, the only section, is the Yoga of Divine Works that sees print before 1950, before his exit in 1950. He writes 400 letters in 1932. He writes, his biographer, Peter Hees, tells us 1,350 letters in 1933. That's the peak. And then he comes down to a mere 900 in 1934 and largely desists from late 1937 on. He writes many fewer letters. But during this core period, he's writing letters 10 to 12 hours a day. I bring it up not because we're studying letters on yoga here, but because he didn't have time to come back and finish what he wanted to do for the synthesis of yoga. Obviously, he wanted to bring something to readership about how it is that one approaches an integral yoga. So, we take this chapter as one of those that has gone through a recasting, a reconsideration, and a re-presentation. So chapter 21, The Ladder of Self-Transcendence. The transcendence of this lower triple being and this lower triple world, to which ordinarily our consciousness and its powers and results are limited, a transcendence described by the Vedic seers as an exceeding or breaking beyond the two firmaments of heaven and earth, opens out a hierarchy of infinitudes to which the normal existence of man, even in its highest and widest flights, is still a stranger. This is very telling. He's brought the Veda in here, the Rig Veda, in, for instance, the third mandala, 61st hymn, speaks of these two firmaments, Dyaus, Dyaho, or Prithivi, the twain, one heaven, the other earth, Rodasi, heaven and earth. So Sri Aurobindo suggests here that the Vedic seers perceive an ascent of the seer, the rishi, beyond these two firmaments. So if we think of the earth as being our world of ordinary living, our mundane existence, and we think of heaven as that to which we can exalt ourselves, here is a Vedic rishi saying you must go beyond that, break that transversal line, and ascend beyond. For most, simply acquiring the celestial status, arriving at the heavens of whatever world, are sufficient. But to the rishi, there is a farther quest. Opens out a hierarchy of infinitudes, because each one of these planes can be considered a representation of the infinite, and they're stacked one after the other, like a stairway, like a layer cake, whatever metaphor serves you. Into that altitude, he writes, even to the lowest step of its hierarchy, it is difficult for him to rise. So this world beyond the heavens of Indra, who represents the god of mind, as it were, is difficult to achieve. A separation, acute in practice, though unreal in essence, divides the total being of man, the microcosm, as it divides also the world being, the macrocosm. So this separation is not final. It is more a film of element than a barrier. It waits for us to qualify ourselves, to fit ourselves for the ascent. If you're going to climb to the top of a mountain, you have to be fit to do it. You have to be able to breathe better. You have to be stronger in every way. And if you're going to ascend to higher levels of consciousness, you're going to have to be fit for capacity, for wideness, to be able to reach universally, to be able to reach ascendantly, let alone transcendently. What is true for us is also true for the world. If we are to rejoin the higher parts of our nature, what is divine above, so too, as we go, we carry the world in some measure with us and establish a rejoining of earth, not only with heaven, but going to the origin of both beyond. So an individual's perfection in yoga has a wide impact. Division must be erased. This fictional separation, we should jettison. So back to the total being of the person and the total being of the cosmos. Both have a higher and a lower hemisphere, the Parardha and Aparardha of the ancient wisdom. Parardha means that which is uncountably above, and Aparardha, that which is below. The higher hemisphere is the perfect and eternal reign of the spirit, for there it manifests without cessation or diminution. Its infinities deploys the unconcealed glories of its illimitable existence, its limitable consciousness and knowledge. It's illimitable force and power. It's illimitable beatitude. Here again, this is resonant with the idea that he's presented so often of Satchit-Ananda. The lower hemisphere belongs equally to the spirit, but here it is veiled closely, thickly, by its inferior self-expression of limiting mind, confined life, and dividing body. So if the expression in the higher hemisphere is the wide, diverse manifestation of an essential oneness, here, that oneness may still exist, but it's hidden, it's cloaked. The self in the lower hemisphere is shrouded in name and form, nama and rupa. Its consciousness is broken up by the division between the internal and external, the individual and universal. Its vision and sense are turned outward. Its force, limited by division of its consciousness, works in fetters. Its knowledge, will, power, delight, divided by this division, limited by this limitation, are open to the experience of their contrary or perverse forms, to ignorance, weakness, and suffering. So this cosmological transfer of pure being, one and whole and integral, into divided being looks like a colossal loss. All the finest essences of our being, in terms of our existence, in terms of our powers of expression, in terms of our experience, seem to be crushed by the disintegration at the bottom of this hierarchical system. But that's just not the end of the story. But the path back is a bit laborious. We can indeed become aware of the true self or spirit in ourselves by turning our sense and vision inward. We can discover, too, the same self or spirit in the external world and its phenomena by plunging them there also inward through the veil of names and forms to that which dwells in these or else stands behind them. So, whether you see it as an immanent reality in all is one, however complex and various the manifestation, or you want to step back into the Purusha status and simply view as a free conscious being all the play on the seeming surface. Our normal consciousness through this inward look may become by reflection aware of the infinite being, consciousness, and delight of the self, and share in its passive or static infinity of these things. Ah, Satchit-Ananda as experienced as an isolated, immune reality. But we can only, to a very limited extent, share in its active or dynamic manifestation of knowledge, power, and joy. Even this static identity by reflection cannot ordinarily be effected without a long and difficult effort, and as the result of many lives of progressive self-development. For very firmly is our normal consciousness bound to the law of its lower hemisphere of being. To understand the possibility of transcending it at all, we must restate in a practical formula the relations of the worlds which constitute the two hemispheres. So, it is a big job simply to get to the freedom of the spirit that allows you to divest yourself of attachment with all the things of the world and identification with ego, structure, name, and form. It's huge to get that freedom. Sri Aurobindo hints that the dynamic manifestation is something still farther. But let us begin here. One must overcome ignorance definitively to gain yogic freedom. So let's look at these two hemispheres. And he begins with a simple but rather grand statement. All is determined by the spirit. For all from subtlest existence to grossest matter is manifestation of the spirit. But the spirit, self or being, determines the world it lives in and the experiences of its consciousness, force, and delight in that world by some poise among many possible of the relations of Purusha and Prakriti, soul and nature, some basic poise in one or other of its own cosmic principles. So he'll define this as it goes, but how Purusha relates to Prakriti and matter in its densification is one given poise. How it relates to the life power in vitality, yet another. How it relates in the mind sphere, Purusha to Prakriti, a third. Each stacked one on top of the other and yet interpenetrating the whole. Poised in the principle of matter, it becomes the physical self of a physical universe in the reign of a physical nature. Spirit is then absorbed in its experience of matter. It is dominated by the ignorance and inertia of the tamasic power proper to physical existence. In the individual, it becomes a materialized soul, Anamaya Purusha, whose life and mind have developed out of the ignorance and inertia of the material principle and are subject to their fundamental limitations. Anamaya, made of food. Anam in Sanskrit represents matter, but it means food. So this is the basis of life. All draws upon that. Purusha, obviously the person. So this is the person who is engaged deeply, exclusively in the field of matter. The real materialist who believes that all the movements of life, all the movements of mentality, these things are derivative. They are epiphenomena at best of this being which is physical and real. For life in matter works in dependence on the body. Mind in matter works in dependence on the body and on the vital or nervous being. Spirit itself in matter is limited and divided in its self-relation and its powers by the limitations and divisions of this matter-governed and life-driven mind. This materialized soul lives bound to the physical body and its narrow, superficial, external consciousness, and it takes normally the experiences of its physical organs, its senses, its matter-bound life and mind, with at most some limited spiritual glimpses, as the whole truth of existence. So, Johnson and Barclay arguing. Barclay argues that the idea is the original conception. It is what is fundamentally real. Johnson kicks a rock and says, "That is real." Idealism versus materialism. Man is a spirit, but a spirit that lives as a mental being in physical nature. He is, to his own self-consciousness, a mind in a physical body. But at first, he is this mental being materialized. And he takes the materialized soul, Annamaya Purusha, for his real self. He is obliged to accept, as the Upanishad expresses it, matter for the Brahman, because his vision here sees matter as that from which all is born, by which all lives, and to which all return in their passing. Okay, this is the famous section in the Taittiriya Upanishad. Some of these things are worth visiting, don't you think? So, here we go. Taittiriya, the third chapter, section 3.1. And you might want to know that Bhrigu, the son of Varuna, as we learn in the Shatapatha Brahmana, thinks well of himself and thinks he knows more than his father does. So we'll leave that one to the side and come here to the Upanishad, where he seems to have learned a little more. And because he desires to know the Supreme, his father tells him to go and find that which is essential. Perform tapas. Find out what it is from which these beings are born, by what they live, into what they enter when they depart. So he doesn't think about it. He practices. He performs tapasya. He goes inside and undertakes what you can expect to be a fierce passage of discovery. What he discovers about the world, he discovers also about himself. And his first look is that he knew that matter, Anam, is Brahman. For truly, beings here are born from matter. When born, they live by matter, and into matter, when departing, they enter. Having known that, he again approached his father, Varuna, and said, "Venerable sir, teach me Brahman." To him, he said, "Through austerity, tapas, seek to know Brahman. Brahman is tapas." So he performs again. And we'll get to that because he discovers that life is Brahman. So you see, we gain an insight, we gain even a realization. And if sincerity is still present, we recognize the limitation of our knowledge and push to the next level. So Bhrigu knew that what he discovered was true, but that it was not a final truth, that it was a limited truth. And he sought the one who could lead him farther, who simply compelled him to return to the world, to return to the search, delve deeper. So that's the Taittiriya Upanishad. Back to Sri Aurobindo. His natural highest concept of spirit is an infinite, preferably an inconscient infinite, inhabiting or pervading the material universe, which alone it really knows, and manifesting by the power of its presence all these forms around him. His natural highest conception of himself is a vaguely conceived soul or spirit, a soul manifested only by the physical life's experiences, bound up with physical phenomena and forced on its dissolution to return by an automatic necessity to the vast indeterminateness of the infinite. But because he has the power of self-development, he can rise beyond these natural conceptions of the materialized soul. He can supplement them with a certain derivative experience drawn from superphysical planes and worlds. He can concentrate in mind and develop the mental part of his being, usually at the expense of the fullness of his vital and physical life, and in the end, the mind predominates and can open to the beyond. He can concentrate this self-liberating mind on the spirit. Here, too, usually in the process, he turns away more and more from his full mental and physical life. He limits or discourages their possibilities as much as his material foundation and nature will allow him. In the end, his spiritual life predominates, destroys his earthward tendency, and breaks its ties and limitations. Spiritualized, he places his real existence beyond, in other worlds, in the heavens of the vital or mental plane. He begins to regard life on earth as a painful or troublesome incident or passage in which he can never arrive at any full enjoyment of his inner ideal self, his spiritual essence. Moreover, his highest conception of the self or spirit is apt to be more or less quietistic. For as we have seen, it is its static infinity alone that he can entirely experience, the still freedom of Purusha, unlimited by Prakriti, the soul standing back from nature. There may come indeed some divine dynamic manifestation in him, but it cannot rise entirely above the heavy limitations of physical nature. The peace of the silent and passive self is more easily attainable, and he can more easily and fully hold it. Too difficult for him is the bliss of an infinite activity, the dynamis of an immeasurable power. Those things, of course, are Vedantic. They transcend the possibilities of the dualistic system of the Sankhya and of all those quietistic disciplines that take you out of the world. That indeed is the teaching at the last of the Taittiriya Upanishad. It's the teaching that's at the close of the Bhagavad Gita. One can be spiritually dynamic in this world, be liberated, be true, be free, and experience naught but bliss. So that's what Sri Aurobindo has to say about this first poise, or this first step in the ladder. And we're on the ladder of self-transcendence. So this is what transcendence is possible for the person poised in the physical, most usually a departure from it. I will sit, I will renounce, this shall not be me. But the spirit can be poised in the principle of life, not in matter. The spirit so founded becomes the vital self of a vital world, the life soul of a life energy in the reign of a consciously dynamic nature. Remember, this is always Purusha, the real conscious being, who establishes a relationship with Prakriti at one of her stages of empowerment, something stable, and develops a dance between the two. So this vital soul is the dance between soul and nature at the level of prana. Absorbed in the experiences of the power and play of a conscious life, it is dominated by the desire, activity, and passion of the Rajasic principle proper to vital existence. In the individual, this spirit becomes a vital soul, Pranamaya Purusha, a person made up of prana, vitality, life breath, in whose nature the life energies tyrannize over the mental and physical principles. So we have a new ruler. There's a new sheriff in town, and this time it's the vital being. The physical element in a vital world readily shapes its activities and formations in response to desire and its imaginations. It serves and obeys the passion and power of life and their formations and does not thwart or limit them as it does here on earth, where life is a precarious incident in inanimate matter. So this is that being above, yes? It's in the superphysical range. Now the relationship is in the vital, reaching up to influence how the mind works, reaching down to influence what the body does. The mental element too is a molded and the mental element too is molded and limited by the life power, obeys it, and helps only to enrich and fulfill the urge of its desires and the energy of its impulses. This vital soul lives in a vital body composed of a substance much subtler than physical matter, pranamaya purusha, pranamaya kosha, as above. It is a substance surcharged with conscious energy, capable of much more powerful perceptions, capacities, sense activities than any that the gross atomic elements of earth matter can offer. Worth noting here, Sri Aurobindo's cosmology, as depicted in The Life Divine, signifies that Chit Shakti establishes itself in this lower triple world, which we're discussing here, as the power of prana. So the idea of conscious energy derived from that, in Chit Shakti, is utterly one. Here, they seem to be divided. And of course, the hint is that if we find the secret, then what seems to separate this world from that and prana from chit shakti can be resolved in the deployment of that secret. In other words, if we want to divinize life and reveal it to be a play of chit shakti, we have to find the secret of the soul. And it is through that only that we can attain the rest. Man, too, has in himself, behind his physical being, subliminal to it, unseen and unknown, but very close to it, and forming with it the most naturally active part of his existence, this vital soul, this vital nature, and this vital body, a whole vital plane connected with the life world or desire world is hidden in us, a secret consciousness in which life and desire find their untrammeled play and their easy self-expression, and from there throw their influences and formations on our outer life. In proportion as the power of this vital plane manifests itself in man and takes hold of his physical being, this son of earth becomes a vehicle of the life energy, forceful in his desires, vehement in his passions and emotions, intensely dynamic in his action. More and more, the Rajasic man. Should we pause for a moment and just note that generally there is an an appellative connecting the physical to the guna of tamas, connecting the force of energy to the guna of rajas, connecting the brilliance of mind to the guna of sattva. Not absolutely, but suggestively, this is true. Intensely dynamic in his action, more and more the rajasic man. It is possible now for him to awaken in his consciousness to the vital plane and to become the vital soul, Pranamaya Purusha, Taittiriya Upanishad 3.3.1. Yes, Bhrigu continues his journey. If he achieves this change with some fullness or one-pointedness, ekagrata in the Yoga Sutras, usually it is under great and salutary limitations or attended by saving complexities, and without rising beyond these things, without climbing to a supra-vital height from which they can be used, purified, uplifted, he becomes the lower type of asura or titan, a rakshasa in nature, a soul of sheer power and life energy, magnified or racked by a force of unlimited desire and passion, hunted and driven by an active capacity and colossal rajasic ego, but in possession of far greater and more various powers than those of the physical man in the ordinary, more inert earth nature. So the asura is the mentalized vital being, and the rakshasa is the being of the middle vital plane, an asura, titanic, a rakshasa, demonic. But to the mother's force, convertible, but by her. Don't wander off trying to lay siege to the camp of these great beings. The asura in the Veda is the elder god. He is the one of vast power. And even the devas may not be as strong as the asuras. So don't go pick a fight. Leave it to mother, please. Arm yourself with light. Become a soldier of light. Carry peace with you. Even if he develops mind greatly on the vital plane and uses its dynamic energy for self-control as well as for self-satisfaction, it will still be with an asuric energism, tapasya, although of a higher type and directed to a more governed satisfaction of the rajasic ego. Of course, mythologies, the epics, are filled with examples of rakshasas and asuras who did tremendous tapasya to gain power, to gain dominion, always with an egoistic and desire-filled motive, and which, of course, calls upon it a rejoinder from the above, a correction, if you don't mind, cosmically and sociologically. Such lessons there are in history when read deeply. But for the vital plane also, it is possible, even as on the physical, to rise to a certain spiritual greatness in its own kind. It is open to the vital man to lift himself beyond the conceptions and energies natural to the desire soul and the desire plane. He can develop a higher mentality and within the conditions of the vital being, concentrate upon some realization of the spirit or self behind or beyond its forms and powers. In this spiritual realization, there would be a less strong necessity of quietism, for there would be a greater possibility of an active effectuation of the bliss and power of the eternal, mightier and more satisfied, pardon me, more self-satisfied powers, a richer flowering of the dynamic infinite. Part of what discourages the spirit awakening in the field of matter in Anamaya Purusha zones is that it seems impossible. Matter seems ineluctably set on its own course and is not conducive to the touch of the spirit. But here, from the vital plane, one has more sway, even upon the form below, this Namarupa, which has established itself as the body, feels this. So this is something that gives greater release and offers more conscious power into the play, worth attaining. Abhaya, never be afraid. Nevertheless, that effectuality could never come anywhere near to a true and integral perfection, for the conditions of the desire world are like those of the physical, improper to the development of the complete spiritual life. So an influence is something, but an influence is not enough. And we will not become complacent with a halfway achievement, with a mere second tier traversed. The vital being, too, must develop spirit to the detriment of his fullness, activity, and the force of life in the lower hemisphere of our existence, and turn in the end away from the vital formula, away from life either to the silence or to an ineffable power beyond him. If he does not withdraw from life, he must remain enchained by life, limited in his self-fulfillment by the downward pull of the desire world and its dominant rajasic principle. On the vital plane also, in its own right alone, a perfect perfection is impossible. The soul that attains only so far would have to return to the physical life for a greater experience, a higher self-development, a more direct ascent to the spirit. Because integration is not finally possible at the level of the pranamaya kosha. One must achieve it here in matter. So we continue the climb only to return to our solid material base, matter, mater, the mother. Her self-exploration in this cosmos through our illimitably numbered souls is launched from this base. In this darkness, light is hidden. I think we've got a good place to rest for the moment. We'll take up our chapter next week, the balance of it, and finish it. So I think the section we should read this evening from Savitri is pretty clearly in Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 1, The World Stare. Let's begin on page 98. There, walled apart by its own innerness, in a mystical barrage of dynamic light, he saw a lone, immense, high-curved world pile, erect like a mountain chariot of the gods, motionless under an inscrutable sky. As if from matter's plinth and viewless base to a top as viewless, a carved sea of worlds, climbing with foam-maned waves to the supreme, ascended towards breadths immeasurable. It hoped to soar into the ineffable's reign. 100 levels raised it to the unknown. So it towered up to heights intangible and disappeared in the hushed conscious vast, as climbs a storied temple tower to heaven, built by the aspiring soul of man to live near to his dream of the invisible. Infinity calls to it as it dreams and climbs. Its spire touches the apex of the world, mounting into great voiceless stillnesses. It marries the earth to screened eternities. Amid the many systems of the One, made by an interpreting creative joy, alone it points us to our journey back out of our long self-loss in nature's deeps. Planted on earth, it holds in it all realms. It is a brief compendium of the vast. This was the single stair to being's goal, a summary of the stages of the spirit, its copy of the cosmic hierarchies, refashioned in our secret air of self, a subtle pattern of the universe. It is within, below, without, above. Acting upon this visible nature's scheme, it wakens our earth matter's heavy doze to think and feel and to react to joy. It models in us our diviner parts, lifts mortal mind into a greater air, makes yearn this life of flesh to intangible aims, links the body's death with immortality's call. Out of the swoon of the inconscience, it labors towards a superconscient light. If earth were all, and this were not in her, thought could not be, nor life delight's response. Only material forms could then be her guests, driven by an inanimate world force. Earth, by this golden superfluity, bore thinking man and more than man shall bear. This higher scheme of being is our cause and holds the key to our ascending fate. It calls out of our dense mortality the conscious spirit nursed in matter's house, the living symbol of these conscious planes. Its influences and godheads of the unseen, its unthought logic of reality's acts, arisen from the unspoken truth in things, have fixed our inner life's slow-scaled degrees. Its steps are paces of the soul's return from the deep adventure of material birth. A ladder of delivering ascent and rungs that nature climbs to deity. Once, in the vigil of a deathless gaze, these graves had marked her giant downward plunge, the wide and prone leap of a Godhead's fall. Our life is a holocaust of the supreme. The great world mother, by her sacrifice, has made her soul the body of our state. Accepting sorrow and unconsciousness, divinity's lapse from its own splendors wove the many-patterned ground of all we are. Jai Ma. Namaste to you all. Jai Ma. This time, I'm going to get myself a photograph of you. What do you think of that? I'll do another. Some of you don't look very happy about it. Okay, so I'll desist. Stay well. The day approaches the 29th when she met him in Pondicherry, surrounded by flowers representing faithfulness. Yesterday was spring, so let's spring forward to that occasion. Joy in the heart, light in the mind, open to the soul's uplift. It will carry us there. Namaste, Jai Ma.